What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we have a lot of comics to talk about, so let's jump right into it with The Flash number one. From DC Comics, written by Cy Spurrier, art by Mike Diodato Jr. This is bringing Wally West back to the forefront with his whole family, giving us something that I don't know that we've ever seen for The Flash, which is a horror-inflected, infused take on The Flash. He is dealing with, it seems to be, Eldritch horrors straight out of the Speed Force. I know I'm the big Flash guy on the podcast, but I think
Did this get to the number one slot?
You know, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And just what I do is I take all the titles, I put them in one of those bingo things, and I spin it around. And then I pull out the Flash. I keep pulling out stuff until I get the Flash first, and that goes first.
Oh, that makes sense.
Classic bingo.
Classic bingo.
You want the oldest person
to
win.
Well, I do think this is a big thing, launching a new version of the Flash, a very different version of the Flash. Curious to hear what you guys thought about this. Pete? Take it away.
Well, it's funny that you say it's a big thing because it just feels like a Flash number one. And I think that the cover was very cool. It was like he was like breaking glass. You know what I mean? It was like an interesting cover.
Well, he's finally breaking glass ceiling for redheads, something that we all talk about all the time.
Yes.
I don't know if as a dude you can make that joke, but I appreciate what you're trying to do.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really love
Alex, famously redheaded.
I love the art style, and I was like, oh, great, a new number one. Maybe this will be you're talking about the Speed Force. Fuck you. So yeah, it
so lost me. Real quick on that, you hate the Speed Force. Why? Because it's confusing?
Because there's a thing called the Sonic Treadmill or wherever the fuck it is.
That's just not,
oh my gosh, so much cursing. Cosmic Treadmill. Here's the thing. If you don't like the Speed Force, Wally spends a lot of time in this book being like, I don't understand what that is.
Yeah, because it's you got to try to deal with it, and it's such a fucking huge thing.
All right, shut up. I really like this book. I thought this was a very interesting take on the Flash. I love getting back to Wally and his family, which is such a great core dynamic that we haven't really visited in a significant way in a while. I also love the horror take here. It's very... I didn't know why we were getting Mike Diodato Jr. on this book, because you wouldn't necessarily associate his dark, very line-driven style with the Flash. You associate cheerier, brighter sort of looks at things. But this really worked for me, and the place that it goes by the end is very dark with this anti-spoiler. Without killing anybody off, I thought we were going to be like, and a member of the Flash family dies, so that might still be coming, but...
Something that happens in Flash a lot, where they're just like, he's dead. Oh, no, he's not. But just real quick, if Alex is Pete-ing Pete, who's going to Alex? And I hope to answer that question by the end of the podcast. I agree with you. I really like this as well. I like the way it is sort of undercutting the big, bright Flash stuff while still allowing Wally to be it, to be himself. In a world that is literally darkening.
In a world, is how you say
it. In a world that's literally darkening around him based on the art and sort of what's the plot that happens here. I think the Speed Force as a force for bad, the text in the last page is the Speed Force is a force for good. I think flipping that and having that be more of, have more of a character to it, as opposed to just like something like gravity that they're just using and working through, I think is interesting, and I like where we're headed.
I just like to say the squiggly lines were a lot, you know, if you like comics where the answer is just run faster, then this is for you.
That's absolutely not.
I don't think that's the answer.
No, that's not the answer.
It's always the answer with the Flash. He's just got to run faster.
But that's not the idea here. I mean, they're finding interesting riffs on Gorilla Grodd. They're finding interesting riffs on the Flash.
Cool last page villain reveal.
Okay.
Shouts to Max Mercury and Impulse here. Yeah. I love them.
And yes, the villain at the end, really bizarre, horrific design. If you like things like the Immortal Hulk, definitely pick this up. Let's kick it off. Not kick it off. Kick it over to.
Let's Ultimate. Kick it off again. Because honestly, that was a little argumentative.
Here's the first title we're going to talk about. I'm sure people love this one. Ultimate Invasion number 4 from Marvel, written by Jonathan Hickman, art by Brian Hitch. This is the final issue of this story, which is bringing the Ultimate Universe back. Here we're getting a setup for a one-shot called Ultimate Universe, which is coming out in November. And then we're going to kick off into a Ultimate Spider-Man title starting next year. We've talked quite a bit here about not being 100% sure what the direction of this book is. And to me, at the end of four issues, this feels like actually a very neat setup for a very different take on the Ultimate Universe. How'd you guys feel?
I like the way you're saying that, because it definitely landed in such a sort of clean place, if that makes sense, where it's like, nope, we are just going to do it the way that you would expect us to do it, with sort of the way we did it the last time. But I think, yes.
Well, so here, let me try to talk about spoilers here.
Fair.
A lot of confusing Hickman-esque stuff going on here, because we have multiple reads and time travel and Kang,
sure, who is confusing.
Also Howard Stark. I'll try to explain it very simply, or as simply as humanly possible. So the way that they've set it up is the evil Reed Richards, called the Maker, traveled back to the Ultimate Universe, used a time travel device to remake the Ultimate Universe, to basically make him the ruler of the Ultimate Universe. Along the way, he took a bunch of very powerful beings, including the Hulk and like Omega Red and Ilyana Rasputin and other characters like that. And
weird
split
picks.
Them, very weird picks, but split them into different factions. And as was revealed a couple of issues back, his whole idea was very much like the Watchmen squid thing of human beings will never band together unless they have an enemy. So every 1,000 years or so, they rotate around where one of them gets to be the enemy while everybody else is the good guy. In this issue, we get a future version of Tony Stark, who has taken on the identity of Kang, has been fighting against the Maker this entire time. And because of the actions of Howard Stark, his father, they're able to get one leg up on the Maker and trap him in his fortress, which is a fortress that exists outside of time. So the setup at the end of this issue that does make this version of the Ultimate Universe a little bit different is the people outside realize, okay, we have 2 years now until the Maker escapes from this fortress, potentially.
Yeah.
While he's in there, possibly thousands of years have passed, and we don't know what's going to come at us at this point. And these factions that he created are like, let's make the most of it and destroy America. So that's one side. And on the other side of the Ultimate Universe, you got Tony Stark, who has taken on the identity of Iron Lad, the Reed Richards from this universe, who looks like Doctor Doom. And this big spoiler at the end is they're going to unfreeze Captain America. So they have these heroes on one side. The villains is everybody else attacking them. And they have this ticking time bomb that they set up the entire universe for, where it's not like the Ultimate Universe is going to go on forever. We know that in 2 years, comic book time, this all goes to ruin somehow. And I think that's a smart, different way of setting it up.
Well, to put a ticking clock on it is really cool. And it's an interesting reframing of the word ultimate, because in here it means like everything is dialed up. The stakes are high constantly, it feels like. Making Tony Stark, Kang, and Iron Lad is an interesting like little steal from the old continuity of the regular Marvel universe, and to sort of combine those two characters in a strange way, especially in light that the MCU is so Kang focused, we think, going forward, but with a very different character as Kang, a person as Kang. So I don't know. It definitely doesn't feel like it's at all gesturing toward the MCU with these choices, despite the fact that we're using Kang, but it feels like it's going to be like the regular Marvel universe just on cocaine, like something we talk about a lot on this podcast.
Yeah, which is weird. There's a lot happening, and it's Hickman definitely goes over my head a lot. So this comic isn't for me, but I was trying to read it and trying to understand. And the part that was confusing to me is, why is Reed Richards talking to the Maker like he's cool with him, when he's clearly a very evil person who is manipulating time and space?
They're being calculated. Like, throughout the book, they know if they make one wrong move, the Maker is going to destroy them. And both this Reed Richards, who is dressed like Doctor Doom, and Howard Stark realize they have one chance to stop him here. There's a whole causality loop thing going on that I didn't mention, where the time machine that the Maker used to remake the Ultimate Universe was given to him by Howard Stark, and so he needs Howard Stark to create it. There's a lot of stuff going on there that either you can pick up on or not. But I think it's a lot of calculated moves rather than big superhero fighting is essentially what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean,
chess match. Classic Hickman stuff. Hickman loves complicated Reed Richards situations.
Exactly. He loves that guy. Why don't we move on to a guy and a gal that you love, Pete? Hackslash Back to School, number one. Back to School on sale October 18th from Image Comics by Zoe Thorogood. Now, just a note, we only read the first 12 pages of this, so we're going to be basing our spoiler-free review off of that. But this is Zoe Thorogood, who we love the art from. She did Rain. She also did, oh my God, I'm blanking on the name of her graphic novel that was fantastic. I'll look it up.
That you wrecked. I loved it.
I'm completely blanking on the name right now. But anyway, this is her taking on the characters created by Tim Seeley and giving them more of a YA bent. I thought, even from these 12 pages, I thought this was awesome and channeled perfectly the world that Tim Seeley set up. What'd you guys think?
Yeah, I loved it. It's kind of like a Batman Year One in the fact that we're kind of bringing things back to the start for Hackslash. This is right when Cassie Hack and Vlad are kind of just starting out together. So it's a special time. That's a cool place to kind of start. I really love the art style. It's very unique and cool. So yeah, I don't want to spoil anything, but I was super excited about this and very happy. And I think that this is an amazing team to have on here. So
team I can't wait for more.
Team of one. But you also team have the team of, you know, that Tim Seeley kind of created.
Oh, okay.
Nice. The characters.
Yeah.
The graphic novel is It's Lonely at the Center of the Earth.
That was
our last year's best of list that you hyped a great deal that I downloaded. Because on your rec. But
it's also just exciting to see Cassie and Vlad back together.
And just like great art, still keeping some great horror in here, taking them back a little bit and giving them like just a whole new place to be and sort of a younger, more innocent, like, what am I doing with my life? Which I really like, blended with no pulling back on the horror gas pedal here. This is just a great beginning to this. I can't wait to read more.
Yeah, I was just going to add on that note that even though this is being sold as a YA book, it's Zoe Thorogood art, and she draws melty, horrific things in such a beautiful way at the same time that it really comes through here. It's pretty intense.
You calling it a YA book is definitely not accurate. It is horrifying. They're straight
up. That's how they're selling it. They're like
children's heads being cut off here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not YA. It's like set in that type of maybe emotional world or setting. But the horror of this book is definitely straight up real horror, slicing heads off children and murdered parents.
Don't spoil everything.
Power Girl number one from DC Comics, written by Leah Williams, art by Eduardo Pansica. Power Girl is taking on a new secret identity of Dr. Paige Stettler. And she is, doing some Power Girl stuff. She has this new identity. She's getting reintegrated into the tech world. But of course, there's some villains coming for her at the same time. What did you think about this new start for Power Girl?
Well, I'm excited for it. I think in the right hands, Power Girl can be a great superhero. I mean, you know, unfortunately, when you read a lot of comics, there is this kind of thing that happens sometimes where it's like, oh, yeah, by the way, I have this new superpower that completely saves the day perfectly for the situation that I'm in that you've never heard of that we're just going to drop here. But other than that, I'm excited for where this story is going to go. And I really love the art.
Yeah, I feel like Power Girl's gone through a lot of changes.
Changes.
Recent time with the Lazarus world stuff. And I like the reinvention. She has a much closer place to the super family. And I think we're continuing to bring that closer. But like, I will say the power of punching a hole through dimension. I was like, isn't this a Marvel character that you just sort of like took over? You just brought
the
power over
here. It's weird too, because I really like the stuff that Leah Williams and Marguerite Savage were doing, where Power Girl had psychic powers and was doing that, but in people's psyches. I didn't realize she could do that in quote unquote real life as well, yeah, and do the America Chavez stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. But like you said, Pete, the art is good. The story is solid. It just seems like a very different start than what I expected off of those previous stories and specials. Invincible, yeah, Iron Man, number 10 from Marvel, written by Jerry Duke and art by Juan Fergari. This is continuing the story of Emma Frost and Tony Stark working their way towards marriage as they're trying to stop Fei Long, one of the villains, along with Orcus, that is trying to destroy the X-Men, trying to destroy Iron Man. Pete, this is one of your picks of the week. Why is that?
This was a big surprise for me. I get it now. When you bring
a second. Can we clip this out already? Can we already clip this? Pete, I get it now. You love the X-Men now.
No. But what I do enjoy is if you have two assholes and you bring them together, you don't really care if one of them's going to get hurt, but it's fun to watch because, like, they have this very interesting kind of rom-com setup to this where two people are faking a marriage as a cover, but what if one of them falls in love with the other one? Oh, would that be fun? I think this is such a cool kind of setup to a bigger story, a little kind of rom-com in the middle of it, and I think that's a fun idea to play with, and I think the Dukes is doing an interesting kind of move with these two where, you know, they're both kind of assholes, so who cares if they get hurt, but it'd be kind of fun to see if one of them falls for the other.
Why are you nasty?
Can I just ask, just to throw it out there, what if it was three assholes? Would it be the same scenario?
Well, sure, maybe.
Together?
Getting together, and it wouldn't matter if one of them got hurt. You'd be kind of enjoying it anyway. Pete?
Are you talking about us? Or were we three assholes?
Is it us?
Really feeling seen here.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I like these characters. And honestly, I like them together. I want to see this. I want to give them the full Bat-Cat treatment. Let's ride. Let's go.
Yeah, I'm into it. I'm having a fun time with them. And I didn't think I would. I don't particularly, I mean, Tony Stark is great. I love him in the movies, but in the comic books, sometimes he can kind of be a little too douchey for me. So I think this is a very interesting combination, and I'm really kind of I'm into it, and I didn't think I would be. So this, it finally clicked in this issue, and I'm having a great time, and I want more.
And great Deadpool appearance as well with the mustache and everything. Very fun. Let's move to another advanced review, A Haunted Girl, number one. This one is on sale October 11th from Image Comics. It's written by Ethan Sachs and Naomi Sachs, art by Marco Lorenzana. This is a book where a girl went through some sort of trauma. We don't find out too much about it, though we do get some hints and teases of it throughout the book. She is seeing some sort of horrific, I would say, J-horror type creatures who are attacking her. Are they real? I don't want to spoil whether they are, but it's an Image Comics book, so you can probably figure out where this thing is going by the end here. What did you guys think about this kickoff issue?
Scary. I bet this is scary, over the scary line for Pete with some of the images we got here. And like we're saying, it's not out for a little bit, so maybe we don't want to spoil as much, but really pressing on the there's trouble brewing. But then some much larger mythological understanding here.
Yeah, it definitely walks the line for me as far as too scary. But I did enjoy this. And I also think the art did a great job of making it accessible. It has like a hint of anime to the style, which I really appreciate.
A hint?
A hint. Some of the stuff
hint bananas.
Some of the stuff was really freaking me out. But I also was enjoying it as well. So this did a great job for me, and I'm excited for more.
Really good creature design in this book in particular is what I would call out. I really enjoyed that, and it's going to be a little while, but I'm interested to read the second one. And I think that is obviously the mark of a good first issue. The last kids on Earth and their superhero alter egos are back in the latest installment of the graphic novel spinoff series, The Last Comics on Earth, Too Many Villains. Jack, June, Quint, and Dirk face their biggest challenge yet, creating the sequel to their hit graphic novel in a mad dash, puzzle-filled race across Apocalyptia to stop the biggest evil plan in history. Hey, you know what the creators of Last Comics on Earth's evil plan is? Make me and my kids love these books. Seriously, my younger kid is a huge fan of both the Last Kid series and the Last Comic series.
It's true.
And now I'm hooked too. The whole team has created a delightful cast of characters with some fantastic kid-friendly art throughout that will appeal to readers of all ages. Buy your copy of The Last Comics on Earth in stores today. You can also visit lastkidsonearth.com to learn more. Let's move to another spooky, scary one. Stuff of Nightmares, Red Murder, number one for Boom Studios. Written by R.L. Stein, Mr. Goosebumps himself. Art by Adam Gorham.
Mr. Goosebumps.
Mr. Goosebumps. I met him once. He was the nicest man. We hung out.
Very nice man. He sort of palled around in the comedy community for a while here in New York. He did some monologues at ASCAT, I believe, and would show up and be around some shows. It was wild.
Yeah. So this is about a superhero called the Red Murder who is powered by drinking blood. It gets tied into some real life murders that entangle the creator of the comic book. What do you guys think about this story?
Well, I think it's interesting because it's about a main character whose name is Alex, who has a quote-unquote brother and is really creepy. And so it reminded me of somebody that I know. It's kind of a Fight Club Tyler Durden situation here. And, it's really fucked up and very dark, but also really cool.
But now we got Pete Alexing Alex. The real question is, who will Justin the Justin?
Yeah.
I really like the art in this. I thought the sort of the heightened panels where Red Murder was doing the murdering was really cool. Sort of the frenetic action was well conveyed. Some fun reveals here. It bounces back and forth a lot where I was like, we're moving very quickly through a lot of things.
Yeah.
And I thought it was maybe one step too complicated before we got the reveal. I thought it could have slowed down and really let us savor a little bit more, but some good axe wielding, blood drinking horror.
Batman, Catwoman, The Gotham War, Red Hood, number one from DC Comics, written by Matthew Rosenberg, art by Nicola Cizbezja. This is, of course, spinning off of the Gotham War storyline. Red Hood is on the side of Catwoman, but we find he has an agenda here, specifically to find the Joker and kill him while he is training some thieves for Catwoman at the same time. Pete, again, this is one of your favorite issues. Why that?
Well, I tell you what, I this whole kind of dividing Gotham, this which team are you on, Bat or Cat, is very interesting. And I think it's kind of cool to see play out throughout these different books. But man, Jason really fucking up out there in Gotham. You know what I mean? Like Catwoman really kind of saved his ass there. And you had an amazing kind of a scarecrow appearance in this as well. I'm impressed with the layers that are going on in this book and the way they're balancing it in a very cool way. I'm really liking how they're kind of taking their time with this event. And we're kind of getting little pieces of it as we go. I'm having a good time with this. This is really good. Art is fantastic.
Sounds like Bat or Cat. You choose Cat, Pete.
Ooh.
You're a Cat guy, so of course you're going to choose Cat.
Ooh, I don't know, man. You might be right, but you hate to go against the Bat. You know what I mean?
Well, sometimes you choose Cat.
I mean, Alex, you do.
Yeah, I know Alex. You know what? Alex chooses the Bat.
Yeah, Alex is a Bat guy. Yeah, for sure.
Yep.
Bats are like cats, but they can also fly, which is very cool.
Bats are not like cats.
I don't think they're like cats at all.
Name one thing that bats are like cats.
Name one thing that's different about them, other than the wings. Mm.
The wings.
The fur?
I guess the sonar. The fur. Yeah. I'll give you maybe ears, depending on.
Cats have sonar, right?
No. Not technically. They purr. That's sort of a sonic assault.
And it bounces off of it. They're blind. Anyway, we don't need to get into this too much. Justin, what did you think about
cats famously blind? I thought the art in this was fantastic. Really enjoyed it. Red Hood is a character for me where I feel like he's so performatively being edgy, and I don't like that as a character. I want to cut through that because
you
what
see
happens
yourself
with him,
in that because you're a performer guy and you think it's too much.
I'm very I'm not performatively edgy. I'm not really all that edgy.
I mean, aren't you though a little bit? I mean,
wait, in what way am I performing the edge?
I don't know.
I And I just feel like at the end of the day, he always ends up being like a Robin. And in this book is a lot of him being like, I'm bad. But then at the end, very light spoiler, what he's been doing goes wrong and he's going to have to sort of feel the guilt and comeuppance for that afterwards. I like him chasing the Joker, but it's like the dog that is chasing the car. He can't ever catch him.
So. Yeah, but I thought it was really cool when a cat did the old slip in the note in the pocket after she called, after he was like, oh, what's up, pickpocket? You know what I mean? I thought that was pretty cool. The cat did that move.
Yeah.
Cool. Good book. Miracle Man, the Silver Age. Good note. Miracle Man, the Silver Age, number 6 from Marvel, written by Neil Gaiman, art by Mark Buckingham. And this issue, Dickie Dauntless, origin finally revealed, and it's darker than you could have ever imagined.
Yeah.
We are finding out about Kid Miracle Man. I mean, okay.
Do you imagine this?
No, I'm just saying it, you know.
Just imagine Stan Lee invents child abuse.
Oh,
right? Something like that. God. Anyway, Jesus, it's very dark. Christ. It's very real and purposefully so, contrasting with the more wild, over-the-top superhero elements of Miracle Man. I think in this issue, we really finally get a sense of why we're doing this, like why the Silver Age is happening and what the purpose of this story is. Very interested to see how they wrap it up next issue. And of course, Mark Buckingham's art, always pitch perfect.
Yeah, I agree. Go ahead.
You go.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I really agree. I really think that in this issue, things really start clicking, you know, like we're getting away from the older material and starting our own story with what's going on. So I think this is really starting to kind of get going in a great way. I could really feel the pickup in this issue, especially the way it starts, where the panels kind of zoom in and get really close. I think that was such a cool move by the artist. And I love the old school kind of art feel that's going on here. I'm really starting to enjoy this. Before, I was kind of like, all right, what are we doing? But now I feel like it's really, really picking up.
Well, it's interesting that there's a Neil Gaiman book that's been on the stands, you know, a bunch for the past 6 months that is very under-heralded, I feel like. This book is not often talked about unless I'm missing some corner of the internet that's really getting into it. Also, a book that is being very coy with its story until now, revealing a lot of what it's about. Not a very Neil Gaiman thing to do. Also, a story that's like spectacularly dark. A thing that Neil Gaiman also doesn't do. So I think this is a really interesting series. I wish people were talking about it more. It's a dark exploration of sort of like a coming of age story, but in a way that is like at once sort of bringing you into certain moments, but at the same time being like, here's something truly horrifying for you to witness. I'm really curious where it's going to land next issue, because that to me is an absolute up in the air question.
Yeah. Let's talk about another advanced one. Doctor Who, Once Upon a Time.
Let's kick off this stack with a book for Alex.
Yeah.
Doctor Who, Once Upon a Time Lord.
Oh, just pulled this out of the old bingo ball. Doctor Who, Once Upon a Time Lord, number 1, on sale October 31st.
Don't spoil it.
Woo! From Titan Comics, written by Dan Slott, art by Christopher Johnson, Matthew Dow-Smith. And Mike Collins. This is Dan Slott, maybe the biggest Doctor Who fan in the entire universe, commensurate comic book writer, finally getting to write a Doctor Who story after years and years talking about the show incessantly. This is focusing in on the David Tennant version of the Doctor, as well as the Martha Jones companion. And the story here is that Martha Jones gets kidnapped by these creatures called the Pyromaths, and they force her to do kind of a Scheherazade, tell a bunch of stories about the Doctor. I know you guys are not the biggest Doctor Who fans, so I'm curious to hear what you think anyway, but just speaking as the Doctor Who fan on the podcast, I actually thought even stronger than as a Doctor Who story, this is a great Dan Slott story. This is a like classic.
Yes.
Dan Slott knows literally everything about this continuity, knows how to make it work in a way that is accessible for a new reader. At least that's what I felt, and draws you in with a tightly woven tale. And then there's another one that is very fun and winky as well. But it's really the main story I thought was absolutely phenomenal, and if it was on TV, it would stand up with some of the best episodes of Doctor Who.
Quote that and send it to Dan Slott on Twitter right now, because he will love to hear that. I thought this was a good story.
Don't spoil it, man. We can't spoil it.
I thought this was a good story. Why? What is my barrier to entry with Doctor Who, though? Alex, can you tell me? Because I like so many comics that are all over the map, but there's something about this that I just... It bothers the Doctor Who, anything, TV, mm-hmm. and no shame to any Doctor Who fans, because I want to like this, but there's something that is a barrier to me.
Have you watched episodes and it's the same sort of thing, or no?
I've watched some of the, like, I grew up on the Canadian border watching Canadian TV, and I watched a lot of old, like, you know, 80s, 90s Doctor Who, and I was like, whoa, this shit's scary. So I've seen that. I haven't watched a ton. I've seen, like, you know, a handful of episodes of the newer stuff.
It might be the casual nature of it is what I would throw out there. Something like, you know, this is a crazy thing to say on our comic book review show, but almost every episode of Doctor Who, you go out and you're like, well, he's going to win. You know the structure of it. It's almost the same structure where he's like, let's go out on an adventure, companion. And companion's like, crikey, Doctor, what are we going to do next? The Doctor's like, look at this crazy planet. We're just going to have a nice time here. Oops, there's aliens who want to kill everybody. And then he stands up to them and is like, I'm the Doctor, and you're going to stop this because I'm the Doctor. And they're like, well, nothing we can do. And then that's the end of the adventure. Like, that's 100% boiled down. But there might be something in terms of that repetitiveness that I don't know why that shouldn't work on TV with this property when that's what a lot of comics are based on, but it might be that potentially.
Yeah, that tracks for me. And maybe it's like nothing ever seems to really bother the Doctor, so everything feels very medium mm-hmm. to the Doctor.
And this is very much like that, but I would urge anybody who has that feeling, go back, watch the rebooted series, because the first one, the first season with Christopher Eccleston and Billy Piper is good. I really like Christopher Eccleston. It's fun, but it definitely has that feeling. It's really with when they bring in David Tennant in the second season where you get that feeling, like he channels so well the idea like, oh no, maybe the Doctor's going to lose. Oh wait, he did. You know, and it goes to that, but like he brings this really intense feeling and energy to it that feels very different. I think that continues really well through the Matt Smith years as well. So, you know, it's the sort of show, there's continuity, but there's not a ton of continuity, so you kind of can jump in wherever. But starting with the new stuff, it feels very different, and it feels like that's what they're going to probably do when Nishuti Gatwa takes over next year, I want to say, where they're trying to give it this clean start and make it feel like more of a global high energy property. Pete?
Yeah, I love this. I surprisingly love this. Doctor Who misses me a lot of the time.
This well, is I thought,
you. Yeah, I don't get it. I've tried to watch it. I've tried to read other comics. With a lot of time, I don't enjoy it. But this was, I found very enjoyable. It got a little meta at times, which usually turns me away, but I thought it was really kind of impressive, and I love the art and the storytelling. So it was surprising that, not surprising really, that Dan Slott, because Dan Slott's a huge fan, but I think he did an amazing job. I hope he gets to write some more.
Yeah, I love getting to see him. I mean, it's a ridiculous thing to say about somebody who's written, you know, some of the most lauded runs on Spider-Man and other things. But, like, getting him to really shoot his shot here and make it, I thought was very nice. Let's move on and talk about a pair of Star Trek books while we're talking about licensed properties.
Yeah, here we go. Let's get into some Days of Blood. Come on. Mm-hmm.
We got Star Trek number 12 from IDW, written by Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing, art by Angel Unzueta. And Star Trek Day of Blood, Shax's Best Day, number one, from IDW, written by Ryan North, art by Derek Charm. These are basically total opposites, even though they take place both in the Day of Blood storyline. Star Trek 12 is wrapping up the main storyline, and Shax's Best Day is focusing on Shax, who is a character from Lower Decks who has been included relatively seriously both in the Star Trek title, the main title, and this Day of Blood crossover. But here it's Ryan North and Derek Charm very much getting back to the humor of Lower Decks. So you got these two very different things. What'd you guys think about them?
Well, I liked the the second one a lot better, just because in the first one, in Star Trek 12, this is number 5 of 5 of Day of Blood. And, you know, we've been talking before about, all right, give me the blood, because they've been sitting around talking a lot. And we don't, it still doesn't give us much in here at all.
Give me the blood.
So that part was a little disappointing, but it's still a great issue. The second one, though, is what I've been wanting from Day of Blood. I mean, you've got head lopping, you got arm lopping. There's so much blood and guts all over this piece. But they do a nice kind of cartoonish art, so it doesn't feel as gory, which is a fun, hilarious choice. But it was just, you know, the Star Trek, it's called Day of Blood, and they don't really do that. So it's a little missed opportunity, or at least mislabeled, I would think. And this one does a great job of really leaning into that and having some fun. So I appreciated it.
It's very funny that you've been waiting in Day of Blood for the, like, light comedy Lower Decks
waiting for blood and a giant massacre or a giant fight, because it's called Day of Blood, and then they don't deliver on that at all. So if it takes a kind of jokey thing to give it to me, then great.
Well, you should read it, and there's a little note in the bottom that you have to add your own blood. BYOB. So, like, if you add your own blood, you think you'd really enjoy it.
Blood, your own blood?
Blood, your own blood.
And, yep. You know, as we all know, Alex likes to drink blood like a wine.
That's right. Yeah, I do. He's a blood red boy murder. And red a murder? Red murder guy, yeah. Star Trek 12, though, and, like, I thought Shax's best day was really fun. Sort of what you expect, Pete. It's a very Pete idea here. But, man, I thought Star Trek 12 was great. Really great. Just a perfect bookend back to the first issue of this series, even beyond the Day of Blood crossover, where it justifies every character's appearance here. When this first came out, we were like, wow, they pulled together like the ultimate Avengers from the Star Trek world, pulling all these baller characters together on one ship. And in this book, we just get a great cold open that just hits all of them in an awesome way. A beautiful scene between Worf and Alexander.
I really agree with you, but it doesn't bother you that it's called Day of Blood and they don't deliver on that at all? Like, it's a great story, and if it would have been named anything else, I would have been so in love with it, because as you're saying, it sets things up and then delivers. But you labeled something Day of Blood and there is none. I mean, that's fucking ridiculous.
It should be called Day of Good Storytelling.
Yes, or, you know, whatever, anything else.
Can I just say something
here?
Can I say something here?
Yes.
I agree with Pete. I'm sorry.
What?
I know.
What?
I had the same reaction reading this, where Star Trek 12, I was like, wow, that's a lot of talking and standing around and figuring out stuff through Deus Ex Machina. And then I read Shax's Best Day, and I was like, yeah, Day of Blood. I don't know what's happening to me.
Wow. Okay. Now, Pete is peeding, and Alex is peeding, and where am I in this? Now I'm lost. Do I have to be Alex and Pete?
I don't know. You got to be everybody, man. You're the Unstoppable Doom Patrol of this podcast, and we're going to talk about Unstoppable Doom Patrol number 6 from DC Comics, written by Dennis Culver, art by Chris Burnham. So the first arc of this book had this really sharp focus. Each issue was focused on a different character and introducing them, giving them adventures. This is like, no, it's Doom Patrol versus the Legion. They're not called the Legion of Doom. I'm forgetting what the Doom Patrol's enemies are called. But it throws absolutely everything in there immediately and goes buck wild from pretty much the first page. What'd you guys think about this one?
This is a blast. This is just a ton of fun. It feels like just a great episode of the TV show. I mean, I still hear the voices from the actors when I read it, which is really fun. But I think this is just a really fun adventure, and it feels like the people making this are having a blast. It's and the art is super tight bananas.
Yeah, the Chris Burnham art is great. There's a super horrifying full-page corpse in this one. in this story, hopefully called Day of Corpse, because that's definitely what we get. But this, you're right. This is like the full kitchen sink. It's interesting to me that this is issue 6 of a 7-issue limited series, because it does feel like it's just revving up. Like, it feels like it wants to go hard in this direction somewhere new. And I don't know how this book is selling or anything, but, like, It's fun. It takes the weirdness of the Doom Patrol and amps it up with an Avengers-type pace and storytelling where the fight, it's just one big fight and then chaos. And then so much of the characters are like, hey, we fucked up only bringing a couple characters to this fight because all the other ones are fighting over there. I was like, wow, what a funny take. So, like, I guess I just want to see more of this, even though it's not at all what I expected when this first came out.
But like Pete said, I think this is right across the plate if you're loving the TV show. It plays into a lot of those characters there. So great stuff. And like both of you guys
even
said.
Even Kipling.
Kipling shows up. We get Dorothy. We get
Dorothy. Jesus.
Candleman shows up in a certain sense as well. So there you go. Miss Marvel, the New Mutant, number 2 for Marvel, written by Iman Vellani. TV's Miss Marvel herself and Sabir Perzada, a writer of TV's Miss Marvel herself. Art by Carlos Gomez and Adam Gorham. Again, busy artist. In this issue, Miss Marvel is dealing with the fallout of the fact that she accidentally wore her X-Men uniform when she was going on a mission at Empire State University. Ooh. Orcus is coming after her. She's dealing with the ramifications of all of these things, as well as trying to figure out why she's having weird recurring dreams, which leads to an even weirder scenario. I think we were all very pleasantly surprised by the first issue of this. How do you think the second issue held up?
It's interesting that this book is a little bit driving Fall of X. Like, it's sort of the book where everything comes to hang out. Like, it's where some Orcus stuff happens. It's where we get the quote-unquote new team of X-Men with Sync and Talon and all those folks. A lot of their action happens in this book. And Tony Stark and White Queen hanging out. So, for this to be the grounds where all that happens, at the same time, it's pushing a lot of Ms. Marvel stuff with the dream stuff and this Doctor Strange Silver Surfer amalgam and her trying to find her place in the Marvel universe. It's a lot going on. I do have a question, though. White Queen, in most of her time right now, she's in disguise as Hazel Kendall. But in this book, she decides to just relax, put on her corset and very tight pants and cape to hang out in a room for a little bit. Do you think she's relaxing into her work clothes here, or what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have different moods. You put on different outfits, get off her back. Anyways, I think this is really enjoyable. I like the friends that we're having on this with the fun dynamic. Her at school is fun. The, you know, kind of will they, won't they with Bruno is really awesome.
Pete loves Fall of X. Pete loves Fall of X.
I just wish two that, books. Like...
Two for two, guy.
I just think that... You know, Emma Frost giving someone advice or a lecture, I was a little like, boo. But I really think that this is a lot of fun and great art, and I'm excited to see how this is all going to unfold. It was kind of funny where it was just like, hey, did you hear that Iron Man and Emma Frost are getting married? No, we should go swing by and say hello. I was like, oh, my God, that seems like such a funny, weird thing to do in a comic book. But I thought it was cool.
Firepower, number 27 from Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Chris Samnee. In this issue, we have our main characters trying to train to use their firepower to fight back against the dragon who is slowly destroying the world. Pete, I know you've been following this title all along. What did you think about this issue?
I mean, it just what a duo. You got Kirkman and Samnee together. I mean, just absolutely fantastic. I love a good fireball training session. You know what I mean? A little Szechuan do. It's great for everybody. I love the kind of villain check-in we get this. And then the, you know, of course, the dragon's destroying the world. I'm a huge fan of. But the art is super tight. Panettas. Thank you, Chris Samnee.
The art is excellent. I have not been following this, and the fact that this is issue 27, this feels like issue 3 to me. So I don't know what's happened.
It's a good jumping on point.
Do you know what this book is like? Chris Samnee, gorgeous art, always like Robert Kirkman's writing, but this is very much in the Robert Kirkman style of like, you go to the deli counter and you're like, hey, could you slice me up some Gouda or something? And they're like, yeah, sure, here, have a piece while you're waiting. And you're like, oh, this is really good. Can I get some more? And they're like, next month. Come.
You just get one little cheese square put in your mouth from like someone's like naked fingers. Is what you're saying?
Yeah, that's how comics work. You gotta wait a month, man.
Robert Kirkman's putting his naked fingers
story here. Is what I'm saying.
Well, it's a hangout book
story.
It feels like a hangout book where each issue, like a couple things happen. It's like certain arcs of Walking Dead back in the day where it's like we're just truly hanging out with all these characters and we're slowly building toward like a series of things. But in the meantime, we're just hanging out.
Yeah. Well, differences of opinion. The first time that's happened on this podcast. The Oddly Pedestrian Life of Christopher Chaos, number 4 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Tate Bromble, art by Isaac Goodhart. This is, I felt like, finally really coming together story-wise in this issue. We're getting our main characters are all in full effect. They're all a bunch of different monsters. We got a vampire boy. We got a Frankenstein boy. We got a Dr. Frankenstein boy, I guess. We've got maybe a Wolfman somewhere, I assume. We've got a bunch of Van Helsings who are chasing them down. This is very fun, and I really like the clean lines of the art.
Yeah, I agree. This is a fun-ass adventure here. This is like a cool group of kids who...
A fun-ass venture.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is very exciting to read, and I love the art style.
Same. I think having like your classic monsters book from the monster side,
like a mod squad situation. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Where you're following them. They're sort of a reluctant teen team and they're up against a truly very powerful group of sort of religious killers, I think is a fun dynamic. I wonder how it works with, James Tynan sort of pitched this, it seems like, but Tate Bromball and Isaac Goodhart really took over.
Here's my assumption based on absolutely nothing. I think this is literally based on no information whatsoever, but I think in the same way that Scott Snyder was like, hey, James Tynan, I'm going to mentor you a little bit and then send you off like a beautiful little bird on your own. I think James Tynan has done the same thing for Tate Bromble. That's what it feels like from all the Something is Killing the Children associated stuff that Tate Bromble has been on and some other things.
Yeah.
So my guess here is that James was like, yeah, I got this idea, but I'm very busy. Why don't we work on fleshing it out and then you take it and you run with it?
That's a very cool thing to do.
I mean, if it's true, I don't know. This is my fan fiction about James Tynan the 4th team. Oh,
please don't start rumors. I do think, though, to get back to something Zalbatron was saying, is that this does really start to click in this issue where it really kind of picks up and things kind of align. Also, like, you get that kind of past that annoying thing where the characters stop fighting each other and decide to work together. So that's always a big help.
When they stop fighting and start being real.
I was my brain is also programmed in the mid-90s MTV brain. So that's us.
The Penguin, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Rafael De La Torre. In this issue, we're once again tying back to the Killing Time series, this time to bring back the character of the Help. The Help, at the end of the Killing Time series, was kind of one of the big winners there and ended up retiring and getting his own mansion. Penguin don't like that. Penguin don't play that, to use another 90s phrase.
Yeah, wow, very nice. Like, we all know what you're – yeah, everyone listening definitely knows what you're talking about. Yeah, Penguin nasty.
Penguin goes really way too far and gets way too dark in this one. This is like, I kept looking at this like, is this a Black Label?
Say, versus the first issue where Penguin and Batman both had their arms sliced open and died in the Batplane, this is a dark issue.
Yeah, you're right. Good point. Yeah, definitely a good call. I do think there is like that violence, and then there is like the Penguin showing you how much of a villain he is and saying like, you can't evolve, you piece of shit, you were my butler and you will always be a fucking butler and I'll murder everyone you've ever loved just to prove that to you. And I was like, god damn, bro. Sometimes I like rooting for the Penguin, but in this it's
what?
Not hard
in what in what cases are you like, go Penguin.
I do that every time I go to the zoo.
Yeah.
There we go.
It is crazy that the Penguin murdered the Help's Help so that he could get the Help to help him because he needs help.
It doesn't.
Was literally this point of this story.
I just don't understand how murdering everybody make like, okay, all right, I'll work for you. It, you know, you should be like, fucking kill me.
No, but I think there's an argument to be made here that the Penguin is right, that the truest version of the Help is when he is not being a butler, but when he is helping people, when he's being the most powerful assassin on the planet, the person who can kill and destroy anybody, the way that he was set up in Killing Time, Penguin comes in and is basically like, you got soft. You went soft, bro.
And yeah, but that's a different argument completely, you know, saying somebody is soft or whatever. But it's, he's trying to say he's evolved, he's past this, he's trying to move on from this life and enjoy, you know, where he is now. And the Penguin's like, no, you know, against his will, well, which is...
But the really help fun. The help ends up rejoining the Penguin. So, like, there is something makes him do that. And I think the Penguin's point and the harsh lesson that he's teaching him is like, hey, you're a weapon. You need to be used in a battle. So you need someone to wield you, and I will wield you. Otherwise,
that's a
you're
nicer
just...
way to say it than how the Penguin is saying this, though.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a sort of the Shakespeare of this comic book universe in a lot of ways.
You call yourself old Billy Shakespeare over here?
No, what I'm saying, while the help, Penguin's saying to help, like, you've just put yourself, you're a weapon on a shelf here. You're training for no reason. You have all these people helping you. Like, it doesn't mean anything. And so I think it is sort of that old soldier energy to play into some of the conversations we've been having about Tom King on our Patreon Slack. This is some of that, like, militaristic philosophy folded into the work here.
Well, it's definitely Marvel Unleashed, number 2 from Marvel. That didn't work. Written by Kyle Starks, art by Jesus Hervez.
Let's kick it off with Marvel Unleashed, number 2. This podcast is just kicking off.
B5, Marvel Unleashed, here we go. This is all of the Animal characters in the Marvel Universe teaming up together in a surprisingly intense situation as they fight against Blackheart and all of hell. There are some badass moments in here involving Throg and
what an actress by Throg. Come on.
Love bats. Doctor Strange's ghost dog.
Yeah.
Very fun book, but also doing a really good job of doing that thing where it's not like, Pet Avengers, that's silly. Let's have a good time. This is like, no, it's silly, but also we can be intense at the same time.
It's very funny. They're like, when's Throg getting here? He's a badass. And it's like, he just has a tiny hammer.
Oh, how dare you? He is a badass and proves it in this issue.
But, like, how many shards of Mjolnir are there out there? Like, can any animal grab one? There are so many Lokis. If you just pick up a little shard, is there a mosquito Thor who's flying around with a even
worthy,
smaller?
Bro, not everybody can pick up that.
Anyways, you tell me, how did this frog prove that he was the most worthy?
He probably shared some flies with some other people and really, you know, opened up his lily pad to others. Yo,
that's the story I want to see.
Don't come at Throg. Don't come for Throg. Anyway, I thought this was just a blast. You know, Alex is right where there is layers to this. It's not just silly fun. There's also a lot of other things going on, which
serious
is really important that you're able to kind of balance all this madness, which is really impressive as a writer and artist. But I think this is just a blast. I think they did a great job of taking an idea and then also heightening it to make it very enjoyable for readers. So and if you're a fan of Throg, you got to pick up this fucking issue, man. Hoo-wee.
Yeah, or if you're a fan of any frogs, no matter what type of hammers they have, magic or otherwise, but they put a frog under the regular hammer and see, they can do some good stuff too. I look forward to Pete taking over the prequel series of Throg, where he proves how worthy he is by sharing his pad with some other frogs.
That would be great. Don't
That's a fun that Marvel. I hope you're listening. Pete LePage writes that comic.
Give me a shot. Come out.
There actually is an origin there where the frog proves himself worthy, but we don't need to get into it.
That's right. What happens in it?
It's too complicated. What's the furthest place from here? Number 14 from Image Comics, written by Matthew Rosenberg, art by Tyler Boss. In this issue, our main pregnant character ends up in a spooky Halloween town. That's the best way of describing it, I think.
I'm so stressed out. You know, I mean, the pregnancy and the past, the stress level of this book was just too much for me. This is an amazing book. The art's unbelievable, but man, the stress of someone being pregnant and then going through all this other stuff is just too much for me.
What's stressful to you about a pregnant lady being put into a Bugs Bunny style soup?
After
nothing to me. That's
tripping
normal.
Balls off some strange candy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was like, that's don't eat that.
You know, we've talked a lot about this book, and I think a lot of people talk about, like, what is that exactly happening here? This book has a lot of, like, vibes driving the story.
Right,
but
right.
Really, I think it is tension and dread that is the ongoing thing here. And we just find – I love that as a spine for a story. I feel like you don't see that very often. And then that allows them to add anything in as, like, the weird – or odd specific that our characters slide through. And it's Sid going, being passed off from two different post-apocalyptic gangs that are like obsessed with masks. It's all kids. And then in the end, though, we're sort of winnowing down. We're just with Sid now, and we're getting to some more deeper mythological things for the book. I just think this is like such a slow play, but worth every issue. I like where we're going.
Creed, the next round, number 4 from Boom Studios, written by Latoya Morgan and Jay Jamison, art by Paris Aline, Leah Caballero, and Wilton Santos. This is the final issue of the story that goes to the far future of Creed and shows what happens when Creed's daughter fights some other people, including robots and stuff. Pete, take it away.
Oh, yeah, this is a lot of fun, man. This really extends the kind of Creed universe that has started with the movies and then kind of gone into comic book form, which is cool. This idea that Creed's daughter is, you know, trying to make her own name and fight. And I really like the use of not only kind of like the struggle with the Creed name, but then also with their skills. And it's also cool, the sign language and stuff in here. Great use. I think this is just a fun extension of something that's already fantastic. So, yeah, I'm having a blast with this.
You almost got pulled into the LePage boxing franchise, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's a tough business. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was Rock'em Sock'em boxing mostly, right?
Yeah, it's like Hungry Hippos, but a little different.
Yeah, I like this book, actually. It's so strange that it was also built around a plot of a business disagreement about robot fighters between the Creed family. And I was like, oh, what a weird side plot that comes to bear here. But I found myself caught, despite, like, I'm not, like, the biggest – I like the Creed movies, but I'm not like, I love Creed.
Yeah,
this really – brought me in over the course of the 4 issues. Cool.
I think what really comes out here is that Michael B. Jordan loves anime, something that he was not so secret about in terms of directing Creed 3. Mm-hmm. And this starts to lead into that, where you can see a thing where, like, they do Creed the Next Round Part 2 and suddenly they're in mecha suits and fighting each other, and it's a whole Voltron-style thing. We'll see where it goes. Action Comics 1057 from DC Comics, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, Dan Jurgens, and Magdalene Visaggio. Art by Rafa Sandoval, Lee Weeks, and Matthew Clark. We're getting two backup stories here, but in the main story, we're focusing in on Blue Earth, which is this organization that hates aliens, tries to get rid of them. Shades of Seasons of Supergirl, I would say, that we're playing with here. Hmm. But it comes back to haunt Superman in a big way. What do you guys think about this one?
All right, man, I love this. I really love the way it started as well, with the kind of construction worker out on a beam sitting there with Superman. Just really gets you in the feels. I also love the giant battle, and it has amazing art. I also love the art style and the backup story as well, the kind of cool style that does. So, yeah, I think this is a great package.
I agree. The way this story kicks off with just a couple pages of Superman being everyday super, it's just such – it's like signature Philip Kennedy Johnson, and just such care with the story. And then the main thrust of the first story in the book is a Clark Kent story that's really well told. You feel the stress and the big future villain story that we're getting here. And then the Dan Jurgens, Lee Weeks story in the back has been great, with John Kent in sort of a lost story about how before he got aged up and what it was like for him when he went on a space adventure that was problematic across the board. And then sort of a Connor Kent Superboy struggling to find his place on the heels of the Superboy miniseries. I felt like this story actually did a better job of crystallizing these ideas and showing just like a kid who is not feeling comfortable, feels like he's always filling in other people's much larger boots, trying to have a relationship. It's not working. Just like a difficulty finding an identity. And I thought it was really well done.
Two quick things I wanted to call out before we moved on. I really loved artistically how Rafa Sandoval depicted almost the Daredevil style human lie detector test that Superman was doing, where you get this cross section of the person's skeleton as he's like lying, lying.
Very cool.
I thought that was a very neat visual. And the other thing, like I loved bringing back Clark Kent news anchor for television, something that I don't think we've done since like the 80s or something like that. Like they just ignored the fact that the Daily Planet has a TV station at the same time. So casually dropping that in there as somebody who my dad had this collection of, or probably still has it, this collection of Superman comics from every decade. And I loved reading that over and over. Wow. And there were three or four issues where he was hosting TV shows. He was an anchor on air when suddenly like, news anchors and news exploded in a really big way in the 80s. And I sparked back to that immediately when I was reading that. So it was a very fun memory.
There you go. Yeah. Pinstripe suit.
Is your dad got them all bagged and boarded?
No. It was like it was a hardcover volume of Superman throughout the years. No. And so it had like three issues from, it had like two or three issues from like the 30s, 40s, 50s, et cetera. It was very
cool. And today.
Yeah. I had a bunch of Van Halen in it as well. I don't know.
Oh, sick. Nice. Just a sweet track in between. I think comics you're supposed to throw away after you read them. They're single use.
Oh, how dare you. Don't throw away art, man.
They're like K-cups, right?
Yeah, exactly. You just squeeze out a little bit of a caffeine hit, and then that goes right in the trash.
Jean Grey, number two from Marvel, written by Louise Simonson, art by Bernard Chang. As Jean Grey is dying in her final moment, she's going through a bunch of what-if scenarios of where she went wrong. In this issue, she flashes back to the moment where she accepted the Phoenix and comes up with a much better solution here that nevertheless goes horribly wrong. I continue to really like this series a lot. I love the reframing of like, in continuity, what ifs, I think is just a smart, interesting thing. And Bernard Chang's art is really good on the X-Men. Louise Simonson has never been better in years. I'm really enjoying this series.
It may be the least Fall of X book, but I agree with you. I'm definitely enjoying it. It feels like such a chill, or I guess an easy way into these Jean Grey stories, and finding ways to recontextualize her a little bit just in as a reflection of what happens to these other characters, in this case Cyclops and Wolverine. I hope we get a little bit more out of her by the end of this, because I'm really curious where she's going to land in the larger continuity.
This really did a great job for me just setting things up and then really kind of like delivering. So I'm going to spoil the shit out of this. But first off, you start with this cover that made me mad. It's Scott and Jean Grey kind of like holding each other and having a really sweet moment. But the ending is like just something out of like a fever dream that I had, where you have like this amazing thing where Scott is kissing Jean Grey and then Wolverine comes and kills Scott. And I was like, yeah. But then he kills himself to kind of like save the day. But man, just a really amazing couple of seconds where I was on top of the world. But man, such a cool idea and so well executed. I had a blast with this.
Pete loves Fall of X. Pete loves Fall of X. 3 for 3.
The Dead Lucky, number 9, from Image Comics, written by Melissa Flores, art by French Carlo Magno. In this issue, our main character is reconnecting with her old flame, literally. Oh, Pyro, because he has flame powers.
Oh, yeah, we got
it. And she's trying to figure out exactly what's going on there. The fight comes back to San Francisco over the course of this issue. I know you guys love The Dead Lucky. I think at least one of you has said that's your favorite Massiverse series. What did you think about this issue?
I think I've gone to bat for this series because it's the it's a one of the stranger ones, I feel like, sort of off to the side of the superheroics, and again, dealing with like the military side, PTSD and what that means when you go through something traumatic and move forward. We're sort of exploring the powers. The thing with the Massiveverse books, it's a little bit like we were talking about earlier, where there's always a move being set up down the line at the same time we're filling out the moves from before. This issue very much a like, we're in the middle. So I want to see I think the next issue will be a good one to really pay off a lot of stuff that's been set up.
Yeah, I love the action in this. I love the team up here. Kind of cool to see them working together. And then the huge fight at the end. Yeah, and they did a great job of kind of giving us that Juno's next time kind of feel. So, yeah, I think this is continues to be a blast.
Yeah, I'll just mention, I believe this is 9 of 12, so we're definitely heading towards the end there, but aren't quite there as of yet. Next up, Alice Never After, number 3 from Boom Studios, written by Dan Panosian, art by Giorgio Spoleta and Cyril Glarum and Dan Panosian. We have been following two timelines, aren't exactly the right word, but one is kind of the classic Alice in Wonderland version where now Alice is the Queen of Hearts and she's being coerced into marrying one of the characters who is in Wonderland. Meanwhile, in the quote unquote real world, Alice has been lobotomized in the previous series. And we have some big things that go down here. I will just say, and to potentially maybe get into spoilers, I think I probably will. I think one of the things we've been talking about with the series, we loved Alice Ever After. I was personally not 100% sure what's going on and what the point of Alice Never After is. I think it becomes pretty much like 90% clear by the end of this issue. And if it goes in the direction is going to be 100% horrifying in the next issue.
Oh, no.
Justify the entire story. Absolutely gutting. And retroactively, I'm glad/horrified that we trusted Dan Panosian to take us this far because it's awful.
I agree with you, and that's my sort of read on it too. In fact, when we reviewed the first issue, I think I called this as what was going to be happening here. Yes, that, and this is a spoiler for this issue, that she was pregnant.
And impregnated by her father.
Well,
right?
I didn't say that. That's my suspicion.
Yeah.
I called that and I said, and I don't think it's a good thing.
Right.
If I remember correctly. So like it is the fact that was revealed here, potentially, we don't know. It's from an untrustworthy narrator that we get that information. So we don't really know anything. This book is just so, it's a dark path we're walking with this. Anytime we're in the real world, it's frustration and bad things happening for the good characters, and the villainous characters are smiling and succeeding. So it's like a very Cheshire Cat-driven story. And I agree with you. I'm curious what the point is, and I hope it's not just like, look how fucked up this is.
Well, that's what I'm worried about, because this is really kind of like crazy and tripped out, but also like manic and like very stressful, because we have a character who can't seem to win or get anywhere or make any good decisions, or is just in a horrible situation that she has no control over, which, you know, is very much but I just think that I want her to win, and it doesn't look like she is ever. And it's very sad and depressing. So this kind of comic is super dark, and I'm hoping she's able to kind of pull something out here, but I'm not sure.
And just to mention it, beautiful art throughout in both of these different versions of reality. Great book to look at, even if it's really hard content-wise to read. Tales of the Titans, number 3, starring Donna Troy from DC Comics, written by Steve Orlando, art by Kath Lobo and Bob Quinn. Unlike the first two issues that seemed continuity-free, this is very much set post-Wonder Woman number 1, with Donna Troy dealing with the new reality of what's going on with Wonder Woman and with Amazons being declared illegal in the United States. She's going on a mission of her own here. What do you guys think about this one?
I mean, this is like holy walking action movie. This is like so intense and fun and hilarious. The whole like whistling and her flying horse stomps out a bad dude, and she's got like one-liners and shit. Yeah, this is just like really kind of a fun action movie that I'm having a blast with. I love the art style. I like how fast paced it is. You can really get a bang for your buck in this, and some really cool covers.
I thought the art was good. Donna Troy takes on like an M. Bison.
Yeah.
From Street Fighter.
Yeah.
So, boss battle. 100%.
Yeah. Huge boss battle here.
People don't realize is like when you're fighting somebody and they got nice dress shoes on, like a great end move is just stomping them on the feet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, step those toes. I don't really understand the larger political implications / photojournalistic ideas here and what they mean, but I thought the reveal at the end was interesting.
Blade, number 3 from Marvel, written by Brian Hill. Art by Olena Casagrande and Valentina Pinti, talking about big action movie, as we've been talking about with the past two issues of this book. It was a big action movie version of Blade. Big explosions, big blood, big sword fights. Pete, blood.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, holy.
This is the blood you've been waiting for, yeah. The Day of Blood.
Holy fucked up bad guys. I mean, that guy's like burning people's eyes out and then sets them on fire. I mean, holy shit, that's a fucked up move. But, man, I love the last page reveal. Love all the action. Love what this is setting up. Cool Lucifer story. Great art. More, please. Thank you.
Yeah, you love a train, right? And we get our bad guys on a sneaky little train that never stops.
Classic Snowpiercer situation.
Very Snowpiercer situation here. Blade setting up to be someone like, oh, here we go again. This great evil, I gotta fight it. Everyone's annoying around me. But he pulls it out here. I'm actually surprised there's very little vampire stuff here, and it's much larger mythology that we're dealing with.
The Schlub, number 2 from Image Comics, written by Ryan Stegman and Kenny Porter, art by Tyrell Cannon. This is about a dentist who switches bodies with a Superman-type character.
DDS,
Superman-type character. And what happens there, they continue to deal with this new status quo in this issue. I know I was a little iffy on the humor in the first issue, but how do you guys feel about issue number 2?
Yeah, I agree with what you're hinting at here. I feel like this does a better job of like kind of finding a flow and kind of like through line and stuff like that. So, or at least maybe I'm used to the storytelling, what's happening in this one. But yeah, I feel like this definitely improved from the first issue. I like the coffee bit. So I feel like this is kind of really trucking along. So I'm enjoying this. And a shout out to Jordan D. White.
What? Nope. I'm curious what the sort of point of it is. Like, I want a little bit more sort of underpinning direction of like, and the, cause I think what is going to happen is the guy who is the dentist is going to be like, I'm going to keep this body. And so I want it to be more than that being the central animating plot of the story.
Yeah, I agree. I like the art quite a bit. The designs of the characters are very fun and exaggerated. I like some of the comedy moves here, but I wish it would go bigger and wilder.
Yeah.
That's my main take. Black Hammer, the end, number 2 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Jeff Lemire, art by Malachi Ward. In this issue, a bunch of our multiversal heroes are mustering the forces to fight anti-God. Meanwhile, on the quote-unquote real Earth, we are getting a bunch of characters who are just like, not interested in that. They don't want to do that stuff. But what it starts to look like for this issue is maybe the next generation is going to pick up the mantle of heroism, potentially fight against this big threat. At least that's my suspicion based off of this. This book continues to be very good.
Yeah, yeah. I love the art. I also really love the first panel. It's so beautiful. Love the art style as a whole. And also the last panel is really beautiful as well. This is getting exciting. I really like what we're kind of playing with here. And I'm very excited for the next issue. They do a great job of getting you excited for more. I also am I love the Inspector guy. And every time he's on
Inspector
panel,
and Sector?
That's right. Fun stuff.
I agree. Like I think this book, and I don't know if this is true, but it reminds me of like a team of characters I would have created when I was a kid, mm-hmm. where it feels like they're right next door to heroes I love. Their names are funny and like the thing you would think of if you're a kid who loves comics. And the fact that this overarching storyline is actually big, stakesy, sort of written as an adult, going back to characters you created as a kid. I feel like I'm laying this all on Jeff Lemire, and maybe that's not the origin of this story, but I really like that tone to it. I like Alex, like you said, about this being like a youth movement book. The fact that this is they're the future. The fact that this is ending is a little sad.
Real quick, Pete, I'd love to get your opinion on this one. What do you think is better, Justin's Jeff Lemire fan fiction or my James Tynion IV Tate Bromwell fan fiction?
Ooh, we gotta go with JT Sizz on this one.
What? Oh, oh man.
Nice. Gotcha. Wait, very light fan fiction.
Green Arrow number 4 from DC Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Sean Isaacs. In this issue, Green Arrow is trapped to the far future, or is he, as he what? Continues to tangle with Parallax, the evil version of Hal Jordan. Meanwhile, back on the regular Earth, Black Canary and Roy, I don't know, one of those Arrow guys,
Roy Harper,
are trying to figure out where everybody is. So, bunch of stuff going on here. Did this one hit the mark, or did it miss the bullseye?
Nice. We get the Legion, let's not forget, just bouncing around in here as well, in this large, sort of out-of-character time travel arc for Green Arrow. I have been enjoying this. The Arrowverse is not something. I wish it was a TV show or something that really got into this stuff.
That would be great.
That would be smart. But I'm not super familiar with it, so I've been enjoying this. I like the Green Arrow Parallax stuff the most.
Yeah, I like the Green Arrow going up against Parallax in this. This is a cool story. It's got some classic, awesome DC art style, which is very enjoyable. I also think this is a good jumping on point here, even though it's number 4. Love the last panel reveal, and the yellow cover is cool and hilarious.
Realm of X, number 2 from Marvel, written by Torin Grunbeck, art by Diogenes Neves. This is following a bunch of X-Men characters who are trapped in Vanaheim, trying to fulfill a prophecy while getting back their teammate Curse from Saturnine, the White Queen, shades of Chronicles of Narnia, shades of other fantasy books as well. Justin, I know you're a big fan of the first issue. What'd you think about issue number 2?
Continue to love this. We got Typhoid Mary potentially cheating on Wilson Fisk himself.
Oh!
Yikes. There will be a price to be paid.
More like cucked pin.
Oh, man. Marvel, make that happen. Maybe the new Daredevil series can explore that idea. But I really like this. It's one of the wilder Fall of X books in a world of wild Fall of X books. But this is a strange world with interesting characters put together with a nice underlying narrative and philosophy beneath it.
Pete?
I like the action. The fighting is fun. The art is great. The Mary maybe getting a love connection was kind of interesting.
Ooh, what are you, a tabloid writer?
Yeah.
Mary maybe. Okay, that's a medium on P for this one. Yeah. That's a 3.5 out of 4.
Okay, I that's what I was waiting for. New Byrne number 11 from Image Comics, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Jacob Phillips. In this issue, New Byrne is making some big moves to secure his place in the New York underworld. Another perfect issue of this book, I'd say, I guess.
Chip Zdarsky is doing a lot of books right now, but this feels the one that he's most meticulous about moving forward. This feels like sort of high on his like books he's excited about doing, and it sort of suffuses through the whole story. Like it's plotted out like perfectly. Like, I don't know what the end point is. It feels like Newbern's in a bad situation all the time, but he's somehow like, I'll figure this out. And that's hard.
Yeah, I mean, this continues to be great. Love the art style. This comic rocks. I also love the black and white backup as well.
Yeah. The Hollywood Special, number 2 from IDW, written by Jeremy Lambert, art by Claire Rowe. This is following a washed-up actress who is going on a train tour, ends up in a mining town where there's been a horrific collapse. It leads not just to multiple deaths, but also to her maybe hallucinating a bunch of terrible things that are going on as she reveals some repressed trauma from her past. Man, I love this book. I really like the first issue, really like the second issue as well, and it gets even wilder and weirder here. The designs and layouts that Claire Rowe puts throughout the book start to feel like a fever dream the more you read it, and I think that's what it's supposed to feel like, so it channels that very well.
This lady likes to drink, I'll tell you that much.
Who doesn't?
Oh, man, that drinking montage that's from her POV was one of the wilder things that I think I saw in comics this month, year, maybe?
Yeah. Wow. Agreed. It was really cool. And I like that we sort of finally progressed the story into the more horrifying part for the next issue. So very cool.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know if I'm, just a missing Riverdale, but this kind of idea that maybe if you die and get to go to a diner seems like a fucking sweet thing. You know what I mean? Like, especially if you can eat for free. I mean, it sounds like a perfect scenario. But, we have kind of the main character falling and, all of a sudden is now in a diner with her name on everything. I mean, oh, that just sounds amazing. But... I think this continues to be very interesting story with a lot of twists and turns, and I'm enjoying it. And the tripped out art style is pretty fucking intense, man.
There you go. The Immortal Thor, number 2 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Martin Colquhello. This is following Thor as he fights against the Utgard Thor, who is the original Thor or the original idea of Thor. Turns out there's multiple levels of gods out there, and they're causing some big, big trouble. Something that Loki wants to help Thor, work out.
Yeah, this Loki.
Can't trust.
Great. If you love eyeball plucking out scenes, you got a good one in here.
You took it away from me.
Oh, you were going to say you love that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the old I'd like to trade my eyeball in for knowledge move. I mean, many times have we seen it? You know what I mean? But.
I know. I gave you that. I gave you my right eye, Pete, and I don't feel any more knowledgeable. Where's the knowledge you promised?
It's there, man. I don't know what to tell you. It's not my fault. No. You can't absorb information.
You just mailed me 4 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comics from the mid-90s.
Maybe that's reread not, them. It's all
that's
there.
Not knowledge. It's definitely not new knowledge.
I learned how to use the nunchakus from those issues, so maybe you should open up your
Oh, thanks. Eye, your pronunciation of nunchucks is perfect. That's all the knowledge.
Well, why don't we move on to a title that maybe used some of that old knowledge, Void Rivals, number 4 from Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Lorenzo DiFelici. This is part of the Energon universe, which is connecting the Transformers and eventually the G.I. Joes, as well as... two new races who look exactly the same but are at war. Here we're getting them returning to one of their home planets. Things get messed up even farther. We also basically get the title of the book in here, but also we get a random classic Robert Kirkman, oh, by the way, this is happening over here scene that involves a big bad Transformers villain who shows up. What'd you guys think about this?
I'm loving this, man. This is really getting good. I love that they kind of, we get maybe a budding love story as well. I mean, these two people who are at odds get thrown in the same jail cell. Oh, only love can come out of that jail cell. But yeah, I also very much enjoyed the shout out to the Transformers movie we got in here. So yeah, this is really hitting for me. I'm having a great time.
There's a shout out to just all Transformers because they're in here. These are characters, so that's nice.
Yeah, but those characters were specifically from the Transformers movie.
There it is.
So I don't actually know. So the character who shows up here, is that Shockwave? Is that who it is?
Nope.
Cybertron? Isn't that his name?
I believe the character who shows up here is called Shockwave, and he's the one
in Transformers
cartoon who killed Megatron and took over, like, destroyed the Autobots. So the implication is, like, they're building up to some big fight going on here.
Yeah. But I do like this sort of our two characters who are pitted against each other and sort of continually screwing over each other, and very much sets up.
That's not Shockwave, dude.
We're not friends. We're not enemies.
I don't remember what it's called. I'll look it up.
We're not friends. We're not enemies. We're rivals, which I think got it. But I do like there's some information given at the end of the book. And the art for this is really nice. It has a nice tone that strikes a little nostalgia while still being dynamic and modern.
He's the guy who's like, when they go to Cybertron, he's kind of like the
That's what I said, Cybertron.
Yeah, yeah, but he's not Cybertron. He was the kind of guy who was running the kind of like teleportation thing from Cybertron. I can't remember.
Yeah, Shockwave. Teleportron.
It is Shockwave. Oh,
it's a different version of, yeah, you're right. It is Shockwave.
Wow, who's the real Transformers fan now? Well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. I don't want to get into it.
Well, Alex, you really are more than meets the eye.
Yeah.
Transform and roll out is the other thing that I know. Maleficent, number 5 from Dynamite by Sue Lee.
Rolls off the tongue.
Maleficent. This book is great and it's beautiful. Every issue seems like a done-in-one story, except it's this building confrontation with Maleficent, and here we get a wizard battle that felt right out
wizard
of
battle.
Was it Sword of the Stone, the one where
Arthur Merlin
and fights I'm blanking on what her name is, but like they have that battle where they keep changing into different creatures.
Yes, yeah, it's great.
That stuff, this is awesome and it looks gorgeous. You guys take it away.
Yeah,
Pete, this is your read.
Yeah, this is. I fucking loved every single panel on this. The art is super tight bananas in such a legendary way. I also love the fact that they're letting the art shine and not having as many words on this. The fight sequences are just so awesome. I mean, they do such a great job of building towards this giant wizard battle. This comic continues to be absolutely badass. When we first kind of started reading this comic, I couldn't believe we were talking about this comic, and now I can't get enough of it.
What a turnabout. It's really gone to Pete's cortex. Like, this is finding its way to his heart. Honestly, yeah. It's like an infection, and I'm worried for him. I want to get him on some medication for it.
Never.
Because this is really like a thorny tendril curling around his neck and body. I also really like it. It does take you back to classic Disney movies when they used to have some real scary stuff.
Yeah.
Tension-building stuff. And that's what this book is.
Agree.
The Avengers, number 5 from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Ivan Fiorello. In this issue, the Avengers are fighting back against the first of their trials, I believe, as Sam Wilson and Black Panther try to stop a suicidal city from killing itself, while a bunch of other characters...
Alex, are you not worried more about the Ashen Combine?
Oh, I
feel like you're not worried about the Ashen Combine.
I love, like, I've been an Ashen Combine guy from back in the day. Like, so don't even get me started on Ashen Combine or the Ennui. That's another character that, like, I remember reading the Ennui back in the day when I was a kid in Avengers, and I was like, I love the Ennui.
I was calling you out, but I didn't realize you were wearing an Ashen Combine t-shirt.
But that's really I'm actually wearing an Ashen Combine turbine.
This is fun. Giant battle, love it. Kill for Mother is such a fucking creepy battle cry, but it works well here.
What I want Superman to say more often.
Some real badass moments in this.
Kill for Mother.
I like the hell no at the end. Very enjoyable.
Yeah, I think Jed McKay, one of my favorite writers at Marvel, like really introducing some big Black Order style villains, but more on the God side of that. that the Avengers truly feel like they can't win against. And I like the way the stakes keep pressing them down. And in this issue, it's like, we're going to win. And I'm very much looking forward to see how that happens next issue. These villains, while being sort of like, don't feel like they have a lot of legs as villains in the Avengers universe, I like that they're driven by sort of larger ideas. They're fun, visually different, and scary.
Last but not least, Kaptara, Universal Truths number 2 from Image Comics, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Kagan McLeod. Last issue, I described this complimentarily as a extremely gay Masters of the Universe, and that's what it continues to be in this issue in an absolutely delightful way. This is like Masters of the Universe filtered through Mad Magazine, but also emotional at the same time, so perfectly in Chip Zdarsky's wheelhouse.
And also channels that cartoon from the 80s where if anytime a teen got wet, he turned into a car. As the old man in this issue slowly turns into a catapult. I think that show is called Teen Wheels, I want to say, and made no sense because it's hard to avoid water.
Yeah. This is just kind of a real tripped up, fucked up episode of He-Man in a crazy kind of creative, cool way. And it's interesting.
Oh, boy.
Wow. All right, let's kick it off with our host slowly running out of gas.
Yeah.
If you'd like to support the show and all the shows, we do patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show. At Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on Instagram and TikTok, comicbookclublive.com. For this podcast and many more, until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club. Couches and